It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Gene Purcell. And you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we are going to be taking a look at people getting into juicing. Our Food Friday guest will give us tips and recipes for making a great glass of fresh juice.
First, we take a look at some news about measles here in the United States. It was 14 years ago that the country officially achieved measles elimination, but now cases are the highest in a couple of decades.
As of May 23rd, there were 288 confirmed cases in the U.S. That's more than in all of 2013. And more than in the equivalent period of any year since 1994. And as we approach the summer travel season, that number is expected to increase. So what do we need to know about these outbreaks?
Here to give us some explanation is Dan Hopsenberger. He's director of the Wisconsin Immunization Program at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dan, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Well, as we said, the CDC had considered measles effectively eliminated in the United States, but here we are with a fair amount of measles. What's behind that?
Well, from my understanding and through the documents or through the press releases from CDC, it primarily is associated with international travel. People traveling to foreign countries where measles is endemic or occurs on a regular basis and contracts the disease and brings it back to the United States. As we say with many diseases that are non-existent, or for polio, for instance, or measles is eliminated in the United States, it's just a plane ride away, and indeed that is what's happening with measles. They contract the disease, bring it back to the United States, and associate with other unvaccinated individuals, primarily is what we're seeing now, and spread the disease to those individuals, and then it just continues to spiral.
So we're a little shy of 300 confirmed cases in the United States as a whole. Not exactly panic scenario here, but is this something that worries you looking ahead?
Well, we certainly keep our providers in Wisconsin through regular updates as to what's occurring in the United States, and that it certainly could happen here. And that any time they see someone with a rash, fever, illness, measles should be the first thing that they suspect, and immediately isolate the patient within their facility in a negative pressure room so as not to transmit the measles to anybody else within the facility or the staff or other patients within the facility. And then do the proper testing on the individuals to submit to the lab for lab verification, and then make sure that the person stays isolated in their home until the results are come back, either, you know, confirming that it's measles, and then the isolation continues, and then, or if it's negative, the person can be released from isolation. What we also do then, it's a communicable disease that is reported to the local health departments, and then if it's positive, the local health department will follow up with all the individuals that have been in contact with that person while they're infectious to make sure they were properly immunized and to make sure they understand what the incubation period is, which means from the time you are exposed to the disease, if you're infected, when you expect those symptoms to occur and what the symptoms are, and then to isolate yourself if indeed you feel, you know, you become ill, and then to make sure you contact the local health department.
Now, the main outbreaks around the country, I believe, are in Ohio. And as you mentioned, international travel, there was a mission group going to Philippines and brought it back there. New York, California. How much here in Wisconsin?
So far in Wisconsin, in 2014, we've had two cases, and one indeed was associated with travel to the Philippines. The other, and that was a pediatric patient, and the other one was a young adult that had exposure in, we believe, Southern California or in Mexico.
You mentioned a young adult. A lot of people, and me among them, might think of measles as mainly an infant and childhood disease. I'm wrong to think that, though, right?
Correct. Our general recommendation is if you've born before 1957, you probably had the disease, natural disease. If not, you should have, if born in 57 or later, you should have evidence of immunization. And we recommend primarily usually two doses of vaccine. We do have school requirements for children attending school and daycare in Wisconsin. The school requirements or the basic requirements are two doses upon entry to school for kindergarten.
Let's talk immunizations a little bit more. I think it was with mumps there were some cases where people have been vaccinated but lost their immunity. Can the same thing happen with measles?
The effectiveness of the vaccine for measles is pretty well documented. With the first dose of vaccine, it's estimated that we get about 96% of protection of all 96% of all people that are immunized will have protection from that first dose. But then that second dose is given to pick up the 4% or the small percentage that didn't seroconvert from the first dose. So by and large, we're very confident with the effectiveness of the measles vaccine. It is one of the most effective vaccines I think we have right now.
If I'm a grown-up, and I don't know, I don't have the records from when I was a kid, I don't know if I was vaccinated, is there anything wrong with getting vaccinated now if I already had been vaccinated as a kid?
The bottom line that we usually recommend is if you're in an age group that a vaccine is recommended and you don't have that record in your hand or that you can prove that you've been immunized, the recommendation would be that you would get the vaccine. With any vaccine that you take, or aspirin or whatever, there's a slight chance of there being a reaction. However, having previously been exposed to either disease or the vaccine is not going to increase the risk of any type of reaction. The reactions to measles vaccine are fairly insignificant.
And there's been some fear, some concern over measles and other vaccines. Links apparently spurious between the vaccines and autism. Do you want to make the case that it's a safe vaccine for kids and adults?
I think spurious is probably the word, because there's been a number of accusations on that, and through a significant amount of testing, there has been no correlation between autism and either the MMR vaccine, which was the original one. That came out from a physician in Great Britain who has since been, his license has been taken away, I guess, for manufacturing information within the study, but there's been no established links with any of the other vaccines as well.
How are our vaccination rates for measles here in Wisconsin?
Here in Wisconsin, our vaccination rates for measles are well above 90%. So we're very comfortable with our immunization rates. Now, we do have some people that personally object to the vaccine, and that is their right, by all means, or you'll have religious objections, or there are some people that can't get the vaccines because of medical reasons. And we have to be concerned about the individuals that are taking the personal exemption waiver because they may, if they contract the disease, they may easily expose someone who can't get the vaccine because of those medical reasons. And say, for instance, if the individual is immunocompromised, and measles and an infectious disease such as measles can be very serious in those individuals. So we have to be cognizant of the immunization rates in Wisconsin and make sure that we continue to promote that it's a safe and effective vaccine, and that, you know, you should avail yourself of that vaccine for yourself and your children.
I know you're making the case that we should get vaccinated just for daily life here. I've also seen suggestions that if you're not doing that, think about it as a travel precaution if you're going overseas. Is that a particularly important time to double-check and make sure we have those vaccinations?
Well, there's a number of vaccines that are recommended depending on where you travel in the world, and certainly we should, you know, any person who is traveling should check what their recommendations are for the countries that they are traveling to and get the necessary immunizations that are recommended for that country or for travel. But certainly measles, with the activities in other parts of the world, should be high on the list.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good afternoon.
You too. That's Dan Hofsenberger. He's director of the Wisconsin Immunization Program at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Trying to pack in our daily servings of fruits and vegetables can be a little daunting, but it doesn't have to be, according to our next guest.
That's right. Today on Food Friday, we're learning how to turn fresh food into tasty juices that are easy to make and also easy to take with us on the go.
Robin Asbell joins us now. She's a chef, food writer, and cooking teacher specializing in natural foods. She's the author of the new book, Juice It, Energizing Blends for Today's Juicers. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first, make the case. Why should we add juicing to our daily diets?
Well, you know, most people have a really hard time getting in all the fruits and vegetables that they need every day. And, you know, you're hit and miss. Some days you look back on your day and say, wow, you know, I don't know if I had a green vegetable. And so it's so much easier if you just kind of start your day or, you know, figure out a time during the day when it's going to be a good time to have a big vegetable juice, you know, so it's really, and it's just quite pleasant and delicious.
I'm curious about sort of the status of juicing these days. You know, it seems like one of those things that trends that sort of come and go. Are we in sort of an up phase of juicing right now?
We are. We are. You know, it's interesting because I've been juicing for, you know, 20 some years. And so, you know, back in the day, it was all about carrot juicing. And what's really started, I think, this new interest is there's a lot more juicing of greens, you know, as people are wanting to eat all this kale and get all this great nutrition from leafy greens. And so we're blending more greens into our juices.
Do we lose anything nutrition-wise when we take the raw vegetable and juice it up?
The only thing, you know, in a good juicer that you take out is fiber. And so, you know, and fiber is good. I'm not, you know, fiber's not something that you don't need, but I already eat, you know, a high fiber diet anyway. So if you're getting plenty of fiber from other foods, it's not bad to then just concentrate all those nutrients and leave the fiber out.
So let's flip that on its head for a second. What nutrients are we missing out on when we choose other things, whether it might be junk food or alcohol or something like that, over fresh juices?
Oh, well, you know, everything. The thing about plants, you know, is that plant foods are really what your body needs. You know, it's everything from phytonutrients and, you know, anti-cancer compounds and antioxidants and vitamin C and vitamin B and all these different vitamins and things. And so if you're eating processed foods, you know, they basically deplete a lot of that because they're just nutritionally void. You know, so it's very easy with stress and lack of sleep and alcohol and different medications to really be deficient. And so juices are a great way and a delicious way to just, you know, boost that back up.
We'll get into some of the delicious recipes in a minute, but first let's talk gear, the hardware. What do we need? What are we looking for?
Well, there's kind of three different options for juicing. One is people want to use a blender, and that's really more for smoothies. There are some recipes in my book where I use a blender and then thin it to more of a juice consistency. Because I always say, you know, a smoothie is a meal and a juice is a drink. Then there are basically two different kinds of juicers. There's a high-speed juicer or the slow or masticating juicer. And so high-speed is just what it says, and that more, it's kind of finely grinds the produce, and the juice goes through a screen. And that is very fast, and also it whips air into the juice a little bit, and it's not, most of them don't work as well for leafy greens. And so my preferred juicer is the slow juicer or masticating juicer because it just crushes the produce. It does not grind it. It just presses it. And so it does not oxygenate it, and it also leaves a little bit more fiber in it, so the juice is a little thicker. So you get the fiber and the goodness of the juice.
And I don't know if you want to use name brands or anything, but is there a difference in quality? I mean, is this one of those things where you get what you pay for?
Well, you really kind of do. You know, I think for a good masticating juicer, you don't really see them new for, you know, under, you know, $150, $200. You know, you don't have to spend thousands. You can. You know, you can certainly find really amazing juicers that claim to have all kinds of benefits for, you know, $2,000, $3,000. But, you know, you don't have to go that far.
So then once you've got the gear, I know a lot of people, when they get, say, a $150 juicing machine, they're going to jump in with both feet. But as I understand it, you recommend kind of getting a slow start.
Well, just with anything, you know, you want to kind of move into it, you know, make your commitment. You've got to have a plan, you know, so that you kind of make a list of things that you want to have and juices that you want to try. But sure, you know, if you jump in and start juicing in a big way, you might, you know, upset your stomach or... And you don't want any kind of bad associations with juice.
Well, speaking of bad associations, when you mentioned carrot juicing, I thought, yum, I like my carrot juice. Gene, again, now made a face.
I made a face, yes.
Can you give us a good gateway juice that gets us into the habit? It's going to appeal to a mass audience. It's going to, you know, get Gene on board with
juicing. I'm not going to make a face.
What's a good one to start with? It's just super yummy. No one could turn it down, Robin.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, there's so many. And that's where I kind of, what I did in the book was really try to come up with some that would make children happy, You know, you could make the ginger pina colada from the Pure Pleasure Juice chapter, the superfruit sangria. You know, that's one that's just red grapes, oranges, blood oranges, and raspberries. You know, that's a really fruity one.
Are you on board with that one, Gene?
I'm making a happy face. Yeah, that actually sounds very delicious.
Yeah, that's one you sip it and sit in the sun and pretend you're in Barcelona. And I've got a blue lemonade that's blueberries and purple grapes and lemon juice, and you can use kombucha or sparkling water and crushed ice and have a refreshing blue lemonade, or the strawberry vanilla spritzer. So, you know, those are just absolutely fun juices. Or you could even try the Waldorf, which has got apple, celery, parsley, and walnut.
And so those all sound refreshing and fun, but what if you want a juice to do something practical, like give you a little shot of energy?
Sure. Well, one of my favorites is the green lemonade, and that one is apple, lemon, and spinach, and cucumber. And it's just sweet enough, you know, to be delicious, and it's got the tangy lemon, and it's just loaded with spinach, you know, and it's really energizing. You just take a sip of that, and it's like, you say, wow, I feel more awake.
You've got one called the Red Rush. Now, we're getting into some more hardcore veggie territory, I'll warn you. But can you tell us about that one?
Sure. Well, that one, you know, it's got some chard and beets and chili. And so chilies are known to raise your metabolism. And beets, actually, there was a big thing in the 2012 Olympics that the athletes had gotten a hold of a study showing that you actually improve your athletic performance by drinking beet juice because it helps to relax the walls of your arteries. And so the compounds in beets can help an athlete increase their performance. So between that and then you've got your, you know, the vitamin C and the tomatoes and the Swiss chard. And so it's something that you can drink and go out and run your marathon.
I love that. I used to love beet juice. I'm the only one in my family who likes beets, but that is tempting. And I didn't know it was that good for me.
And what about if you want to relax a little bit? Is there a good juice for that?
Well, I've got some relaxing juices. Like there's the Sleepy Salad, which is... Actually, we've known since Roman time that lettuce has a tranquilizing effect. So that's in the blend. And there's also Grape Night's Sleep, which is grapes and lettuce and chamomile tea. And that's, you know, a good one to help you sort of relax and start falling asleep.
Now, suppose you're out shopping for ingredients. You've got your recipes maybe with you to pick out produce. What's the best way to buy, make sure you've got good stuff for juicing?
Sure. Well, you want to make sure, because a lot of these, the benefits are in the skin, especially of, say, apples and cucumbers. So you want to get organic, you know, and just get really fresh, you know, ripe produce. And now is the time. I actually planted a juice garden, and I also go to the farmer's market, and this is the time of year when you can get, you know, really great deals on really fresh produce, and you can just, you know, get your, I planted beets and carrots and kale and spinach and cucumbers, and so I can just go out in the garden and pull it right out of the ground and juice it.
And I have to say, though, we just came through a pretty long winter in Wisconsin, which just wrapped up yesterday, basically. You know, for those of us who live in some of these colder climates, what can we do during the winter months?
Well, that's when I really feel it's important to keep juicing, you know, because, yeah, I'm in Minnesota, so I know how it's been.
Yeah, it's been.
And so, yeah, it seems like we were just shoveling the other day, and now it's 85. But I've got juices in there like the Sniffle Squelcher, which is the pineapple, kiwi, orange, and echinacea tea to help you build your immunity. Because in winter, you know, it gets really easy to start eating heavy food, and, you know, you start kind of staying inside in the darkness, and so you really kind of need to, it's kind of like drinking some liquid sunshine, you know, to bring in your produce and kind of drink it.
So, Robin, before I let you go, what juice have you had or are you about to have today?
You know, today I made a kale and parsley and apple and lemon, so kind of a variation on my lemonade, and I threw a little some ginger in there too. I really like a little kick of ginger.
That sounds great. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Robin Asbell. She's author of Juice It, Energizing Blends for Today's Juicers. And by the way, if you head over to the Central Time Facebook page, we have a link to her page. And there, if you search around, there are a bunch of great juice recipes to get you started. Check them out.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, a look at today's resignation of VA Chief Eric Shinseki and the ongoing scandal that led to his departure.
But first, we take a look at some of the fascinating science behind the human brain and what happens when things go wrong.
Our next guest says there's a lot we can learn about our brains by looking at some of the most unusual and interesting brain injuries of all time. In a new book, he tells the stories of the people who suffered those injuries and what life was like for them.
Joining us now is Sam Keen. He is an award-winning science writer and author. His newest book is The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. The history of the human brain is revealed by true stories of trauma, madness, and recovery. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first, I want to start out with this idea of trauma, madness, and recovery. There are a lot of terrific stories in this book, but the gist of it, and we have to get to it sooner or later, is that for so many of these stories, the only way to take a look at how the human brain works, and for many years, was to, after it was damaged, was sort of to observe people. And there's a lot of gore and stuff in here. And some of the stories are not pleasant, but it is the way it is and was for centuries.
Yeah, if you think about the way neuroscience progressed, they really didn't have a good way to look inside the brain for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And they just had to wait for accidents, misfortune to strike people. And then depending on what part of the brain got damaged, they would see that, oh, this person suddenly became a pathological liar, or, you know, parents couldn't recognize their children anymore. And it was only by basically marching around the brain from part to part and cataloging what happens when each part gets injured, that we had any sort of insight into what the different parts of the brain did. It was how neuroscience progressed for hundreds and hundreds of years.
And as you say, hundreds and hundreds of years, your book begins back in the 1500s with the first, I think, documented concussion. It's an interesting story of King Henry II and what we learned from his injury. And it's a little on the gruesome side. So with that in mind, could you tell the story and kind of how this whole book gets started?
Yeah, it's not that bad, I promise.
It's sort of gruesome, I don't know.
A little bit. So King Henry was kind of this macho king. He liked to do things like go jousting, and he ended up getting sort of clobbered in the head one day while they were having a joust. Unfortunately for him, he ended up suffering a massive concussion. And so they brought in the two best neurosurgeons in Europe to try to help him. They were kind of rivals before, so that was the dueling part of the dueling neurosurgeons. But they banded together to try to help the king. And in fact, because Henry did not have a really gory wound, because there wasn't anything, you know, obviously wrong from the outside, his skull wasn't cracked open, there was no bleeding, anything like that. They actually, a lot of the doctors there thought that he would get better. They sort of thought of the head like we think of an egg, where if the shell isn't cracked, then the yolk inside must be fine. They reasoned that if the skull wasn't cracked, then the brain inside must be A-okay. But these two famous neurosurgeons reasoned differently, and they realized that even though his skull was okay looking from the outside, he still had suffered a massive concussion on the inside. And I thought it was a good pick for the title for a few reasons. One, we usually don't think about neurosurgery going on in the 1500s, but in fact, these kind of procedures date all the way back there and even farther back in history. So you really get to see the entire sweep of neuroscience from its very beginning all the way up into modern times. And in fact, we're still dealing with a lot of these issues today. You hear about, football players, hockey players who suffer concussions, and because there's no obvious injury on the outside, they go right back on the field. You hear about soldiers who have low-level but pervasive brain damage, and they have trouble convincing people that there's really something wrong because, again, there's no obvious injury from the outside. So we're still dealing with a lot of these issues, still learning a lot of these lessons today. So a lot of these old stories are very applicable to the way we understand the brain now.
And it's interesting because you mentioned, you know, the concussion focus that we've got right now going on. But here we are 450 years after King Henry II, and we still don't fully understand everything about concussions. And sort of extrapolating from that, what does that tell you about the complexity of the human brain and our ability to truly understand what's going on in there?
Yeah, in some ways it's easier if it's a very small wound in a specific spot because that gets damaged and, you know, people suddenly lose a talent. They lose some sort of mental ability and you can say, okay, well, we know it clearly what's going on in this case because these circuits, these certain neurons were destroyed. With concussions, it's tougher because, again, as you said, it involves the entire brain. And one of the big themes of the book is that when you're looking at anything complicated in the brain, language, memory, personality, all of those things really involve lots and lots of different areas in the brain. There's no single language spot. There's no single memory spot. It's systems of things working together. And we only have a vague idea of how those systems work together. So that is a problem with concussions is we need to understand more thoroughly how different parts of the brain communicate and how they produce these kind of big high-level things.
A lot of other brain injuries in the book, and some that people might be familiar with, and I'm going to mention one of those now. And the Phineas Gage might not mean anything if I say the name, but if I say the injury, that I think a lot of people remember the photo. And it was a guy in the, 1840s, mm-hmm. and he was loading gunpowder, like, into a mine or a cannon or something like that, and a rod blew out, went through his head, and took out his eye and a chunk of his brain with it. And he was very famous in his time, and not just among the general public, but also among scientists. And he's one that is remembered certainly today in the annals of science and one that people might be familiar with. What's his story?
Yeah, so Phineas Gage, railroad worker, and exactly as you said, he had a railroad spike basically blast to the top of his head. Incredibly, he didn't even lose consciousness, he reported. He got up, he walked away from this, was driven into town, walked up the stairs to his room, and got treatment there. So it's incredible you can have an injury like that and even survive it. But the reason Phineas Gage became so famous was that his personality changed afterward. And actually, the story of Phineas Gage is kind of being revived by historians today. A lot of people learn the story in, you know, a psychology class or something like that, but in all likelihood, they learned an incorrect version of the story in that they learned that Phineas Gage became sort of this criminal or a drunken lout or some sort of disreputable person. But there's actually almost no evidence that this happened to Phineas Gage. And in fact, there is some evidence that he recovered and became, you know, not normal again. He never recovered everything, but he might have recovered somewhat over time. For instance, he ended up going down to Chile and driving a stagecoach down there for 7 years, basically on his own, independently. That doesn't sound like someone who's suffering from severe brain damage, severe personality disorders, things like that. So in the end, I think Phineas Gage's story is actually one of hope. There are stories of injuries throughout the book, but he's one of the cases of people who might have gotten better over time. And that really highlights, again, one of the important themes of the book, that the brain is amazing in its ability to recover, to heal itself, to compensate for its deficits. It does things that the other organs in the body simply can't do. And these tales of recovery throughout the book are really incredible.
Yeah, and one of the things I think you try to do in the book is, I think a lot of people, if they would think of a Phineas Gage, they'd almost think of him almost as a specimen, you know, something to to look at and to study. And what I think you've tried to do is there's a story surrounding each one of these cases. And you always, you've been pointing out that there's a person there. There was a person there before, and there's a person thereafter, too.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the real goals of the book, was to take even these famous cases that people have heard about and show you the real person there. You know, in a lot of these cases, the people can still do most of the things that we can do. They can still walk and talk. You know, a lot of them can still remember things. And more importantly, they approach life the same way. They feel the same disappointments that we do. They, you know, feel the same joys that we do. All of these things. And you can really only understand what the brain damage did to them, how it changed them, by looking at it in the context of their entire life. And you really do get a richer, deeper picture of how the brain works if you look at the entire person all the way through.
And I'm wondering, you know, as you went into this book, how your perception of the brain, brain injuries, that sense of being human, did that change as you were writing the book, as you read some of these stories, as you fleshed them out?
Yeah, there were a couple things I can point to that changed. One, as I mentioned before, there's almost no really important feature in the brain, language, memory, things like that, that is located in one spot in the brain. Really, it's your entire brain working together to bring these complicated faculties out. So that's one thing. The other thing I really think that I learned is that there's a lot more going on than our rational, conscious brain. We have a lot of processing going on unconsciously that we don't normally think about. We don't normally take into consideration. But really, that's the bulk of what's going on in our brain. So I really think doing all this research, writing all this, really helped me understand my own thought processes and what's really motivating me, what's really helping me decide things. And, you know, there's always the thing, too, like medical students, where they sort of famously start to feel sick when they read about every single disease in the book. And you start to think about your own thought processes like that. You wonder, you know, is this something going on in my brain? You know, is it something I learned? Is it something innate? Things like that. So it's really fun to kind of pick apart your own thought processes like that and see what makes your own mind tick.
We're talking with Sam Keen about some of the most unusual brain injuries and conditions throughout history and what we can learn from them even now in 2014. We'd like you to join the discussion, too, with your questions and your comments. Here's our phone number, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how the brain works? What parts of the brain are important? What about those unconscious things that happen behind the scenes all the time? 800-642-1234. And we'll pick up that conversation in just a moment.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Sam Keen. He is the author of The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, about some of the most interesting and unique neurological injuries and conditions, and what we can learn about our brains from those injuries. You can join the conversation with your questions, your comments, at 800-642-1234. Sam, we talked about some of the how we start the book out. We talked a little bit about Phineas Gage. Anybody in here that you'd like to focus on that maybe people aren't familiar with, maybe a discovery that you made while you were writing the book?
Yeah, one of the real stories that sticks out to me was a woman who lives in Iowa, still alive today, who came down with a rare disease that destroyed what are called the amygdala in her brain. The amygdala are very involved with processing fear, and because of that, she basically lost all ability to feel fear in her daily life. She became utterly and completely fearless. And the studies of her are actually kind of a hoot to read about because they basically consist of scientists trying to think up ever more elaborate ways to frighten her.
Oh,
so,
my gosh,
you know,
yeah.
They'll bring her to exotic pet stores and show her snakes. They'll bring her to haunted houses. They'll try to show her scary movies, things like that. But she really provided some interesting insight into how we process fear in the brain and why fear is important for, you know, our day-to-day lives and how we live our lives.
Lots of other interesting stories in the book, too. And, you know, when part of it that struck me when I was taking a look through some of these stories is how it impacted the way that people with mental conditions or brain injuries were treated in terms of surgery. You know, you think of lobotomies and so forth. Those kind of came, I think, directly out of some of this thinking and sort of experimenting with these various portions of the brain, trying to see, poking and prodding, what does what.
Yeah, there were a few cases when neurosurgery got going in the 1900s where they were working a little blind and they tried different things. There was a very famous memory patient, an amnesiac named H.M., who they destroyed a couple of structures in his brain called the hippocampus. And that ended up leaving him basically with no memory whatsoever. So, yeah, there were cases of where they were doing these types of surgeries, ended up, you know, making a mistake or getting rid of something that turned out to be vital, and people change really dramatically afterward. At the same time, though, there are also natural cases where just because of quirks in somebody's brain, we can learn insights through that way, too. And we talked a little bit about how these stories are still applicable today. There's one part of the book where I talk about these two girls. They're twins, conjoined twins, what used to be called Siamese twins. They're actually conjoined at the brain, at the head. They live in Vancouver, in Canada now. And they share a part of the brain called the thalamus, which is very involved in processing and relaying sensory information. Because they share a thalamus, they actually share sensory information with each other. So when one girl, say, takes a sip on a cup of juice, the other girl can actually taste the juice in her mouth. Or if you give one girl a shot at the doctor, the other girl feels the pain in her arm. Or you can tickle one of them and the other one will laugh. So we really do learn some fascinating things about even just kind of quirks of the brain, even without these tales of injuries, things like that.
Yeah, and I remember there was another story about somebody, you mentioned somebody who couldn't remember anything. There was somebody else in your book where literally remembered everything. And, you know, that didn't work out very well either, but it seems as though the combinations here are almost infinite in terms of what can happen because it is so complex, because it is so interrelated, because if you affect one part, you're not sure what's going to happen to the other parts.
Right, exactly. So that's why we're still learning a lot of these things today. We've probably seen cases of people getting injured in each specific part of the brain in isolation. But then, exactly as you said, if you start to damage two things at once, three things at once, all of a sudden these new symptoms come up and we start to learn even more subtleties about the way the brain works. And right now, neuroscientists are using these kind of case studies to explore really high-level things in the brain, things like free will, our sense of consciousness, our sense of personal identity and sense of self. So even these really big, high-level philosophical things, you can get at, you can study them through these types of cases.
We've got some listeners who would like to join in, and if you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234. But let's go to the phones right now, and we begin with Barbara, who joins us from Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, my brother suffered a stroke that damaged the part of his body that controls coordination. And, you know, he went from a vibrant, mature adult to someone who can't walk and can barely feed himself. Is there anything that's any advancements that we can make in stroke recovery that's coming from some of this research?
That's a very good question, Barbara. Of course, Sam Keen, strokes are brain injuries, aren't they?
Yeah, basically they're damage to the brain. Often, say, a blood vessel tear or something like that, and fluid builds up. And because the brain's in an enclosed space, it can end up crushing cells, things like that. I would say as much as anything, there has been an advance in the way we treat stroke patients in that there's a lot more willingness now to think of people as able to recover. For, you know, a long, long time, neuroscientists assumed that as soon as you lost a faculty, you were done for, and there was no chance you would ever recover. But I talk about some cases in the book where people end up, you know, paralyzed, unable to feed themselves, unable to do anything, but because they subscribed to a strict rehab regimen and kept working over a very long time, they were able to take advantage of brain plasticity, the brain's ability to recover itself. It's very hard work. The brain does take a long time to recover any lost abilities, but it can happen in the brain.
And you also, in the book, you talk about that interrelated nature of things, that sometimes a couple parts of the brain are engaged in the same activity. And so if one part of the brain is damaged, that doesn't necessarily mean that that entire activity has to end. That just means it has to adapt, I guess.
Yeah, the brain has to adapt. It might route information around it, or it might come up with a compensation strategy. You know, there are stories of people who lose all ability to recognize animals suddenly. They can't tell dogs from cats, from raccoons, from elephants. They just lose that ability. But they can compensate sometimes by, you know, listening to the animal, by watching the way it walks, because different animals walk differently. So they can sort of regain these abilities through, you know, the brain kind of rehabbing or developing compensation strategies.
Yeah, and one of the things you talk about in the book that was interesting, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to pronounce it correctly, synesthesia, where one sense actually triggers another.
Synesthesia.
There you go. Thanks for that.
Synesthesia, yes. So synesthesia, yes, it's where your senses blend together in kind of this trippy, unusual way. So you'll hear a musical tone, and then all of a sudden you'll see colors flashing in front of your eyes. Or you'll look at a number on a page, like a 5 or a 7, and you'll see it in a bright color, like a green or a yellow, something like that. This is fairly common. It's not that unusual for people to experience some sort of synesthesia where one sense triggers another. But there are actually lots and lots of different kinds of synesthesia. I mentioned the most common kind, but sometimes people's, you know, tactile senses get mixed up. So they'll feel a fence and then they'll taste something in their mouth. A fence will taste salty. Or, you know, they'll feel an orange peel and they'll get a different kind of taste in their mouth. So there's all sorts of unusual ways that the brain's senses can be connected to each other. And you get all sorts of really interesting tales of what happens to people, how they experience the world. And often these people with synesthesia feel, you know, kind of sorry for the rest of us that we don't experience the world in this rich, colorful, interesting way like they do.
So now that the book is done and it's out, what do you hope people take away from it? I mean, I imagine what you're hoping is that these aren't just a collection of old stories. Some of them are very old. Some of them are much more modern. But I'm guessing that you're hoping for more than just a history lesson.
Yeah, I think what people will get out of it is they'll get a sense of what every single part of the brain does as we march around from part to part. So you'll get a good lesson, basically, in how the brain works. You'll get a better sense of how the parts of the brain work together, which is very important for understanding how your own thoughts work, how other people's thoughts work, things like that. And I think at the end of it, you also will get a good sense of what's going on and how to approach things in neuroscience in the future. So when new breakthroughs, new ideas come out, I think after reading the book, you'll have a better sense of what they mean, some context for them. You'll be able to understand a lot more about the science going forward as well.
And some good exercises and rebuses too.
There's a few puzzles in there for people who like that kind of thing. Kind of a nice little break. Use a different part of your brain, I guess.
Well, Sam, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Sam Keen is the author of The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain, as revealed by true stories of trauma, madness, and recovery.
Coming up next, Eric Shinseki is out. He resigned from his Veterans Affairs post today, but the scandal continues at the VA. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.